Don't I look fantastic with a wig? Huh? That's me. Alas, what 17th century powdered wigs and...
Yes.
I really think I could get away with walking around looking like that all the time.
Yeah, you,
don't
you? You could pull it off.
Yeah. Mm. And look how grumpy I look.
It's perfect.
It's perfect for me. I love it. All right, speaking of grumpy, James, I just sent you this picture now. You can pop it up when you get a chance. Prancer, a 13-pound gremlin chihuahua who hates men and children... and was described as a vessel for a traumatized Victorian child, has been adopted by a 36-year-old single lesbian in Connecticut in the United States. So Prancer.
Well, they'd have to be a lesbian woman because
yeah, because he hates men and children. Yeah. So that's Prancer, the gremlin chihuahua. And you must see this thing's facial expression. You think I'm grumpy in a wig. You have no idea. Prancer is something else.
Yeah, chihuahuas.
They're horrible little things, hey?
They're not many nice chihuahuas, nice to other people.
They're not. They're very cross
very
little dogs.
Very protective of their owners. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you looked like that, wouldn't you be cross? So the big stories this week, and we'll get into this with Chris Hart, no doubt, because the world economy is focused on Trump's trade war at the moment.
Mm.
And he's, some people think he's a genius and some people think he's a complete idiot.
Yeah.
The Chinese are very stuck at the moment because what he seems to be trying to do is to isolate them. The Chinese economy will not survive being cut off from America.
Says who?
Well, this is what economists are saying. And mostly people who understand this stuff much better than I do and who I'm gleaning this information from on the internet. You know, voices that I respect. We'll find out from Chris Hart what he thinks, because he is one of the voices I respect when he comes in later. But China is where most of the world's stuff is made.
Mm.
So I kind of like where we're at as a country. We can be friends with America and we can be friends with China.
Listen, China is, as we speak, reaching out to us, offering us real iPhones, real products that are made perfectly well, and because they're made for the US market, and saying, well, look, here's a truck full.
So if we can't sell them to America, we'll sell them to you.
They are not acting out of fear, which makes me think they may be right. I think it was a trade minister of China was interviewed on an Australian news network.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if the US thinks that they can put a dent in this, in our economy, it's laughable. We can regain that 15% very easily elsewhere. We are not afraid, and he must do it because we need to prove a point now. There's no fear that even right down to just members of the public watching their activity on social media, the way they're coming out and mocking this whole thing. At any point, you can go on to, because I'm now in it, it's mm-hmm. on my feed.
Who knew we'd be
Chinese
talking about
manufacturers
tariffs?
Coming directly. Hey, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana, come and, you know, make a deal with my factory.
Yeah, but okay, so here's the problem. There are a number of different ways we can take this conversation. First, let's look at how it affects us, okay? Because I think that's what matters to most South Africans. It's like, how does it, if I order stuff from China, is it going to affect me? Probably not. I mean, we've already got tariffs and taxes and charges in place. That's why when you buy things from Alibaba or from Temu or from Shein, you will be charged a customs and tax on its way in, right?
Yeah.
And that you have to pay to our government. That's not because we've got a tariff agreement with China. That's because our government want their slice of the pie, even though they're not entitled to any of it. If you ask me, they still want some because they've got to make their money somewhere. They're not capable of making it legitimately, so they have to just take some of yours. So that's not going to change from what I can tell. Mm-hmm. If you're in America, though, and you were ordering on Temu last week, and now you're going to do it in a couple of weeks' time, I believe there's a freeze that's been put on by Trump on these tariffs for a little while, 90 days or something. But you'll find at the end of that period, a whole lot more expense.
But
it's going to cost you a lot more, twice as much.
That's a minute scale on a minute scale is ordering people ordering stuff. The big thing is manufacturing. So for instance, if you take designer handbags, like a Gucci handbag or whatever, mm-hmm. China makes those and they send them to the US, or mm-hmm. if it's a French brand, they'll send it to Europe, where the final step is for the company in either the US or Europe to put on the logo and package it. They do not know how to make those bags. They don't have the leathers. They don't have the studs, mm-hmm. the patterns. They don't have the manpower. They don't have the artisans mm-hmm. who hand sew those things. And I don't think that they realize that there are entire cities bigger than San Francisco, which produce only one type of product. Mm-hmm. And that they've been building this up for 15 years to be in this position.
Oh, yeah.
And Trump is of the opinion that they're going to come begging and say, we'll set up our factory in America. There's no ways they're giving up their billion-dollar position.
There could be a number of other factors at play here as well. I mean, America does have the lion's share of world trade going in and out. They can determine the price of things. And I think it would be interesting also to consider that for some people, it's not just about trade. This is about currency and playing with currencies, you know, currency inflation. It could have to do with the trade deficit, the surplus that some countries have over others. We'll talk to Chris Hart about all of these. I think he'll be an interesting man to ask about it. But Donald Trump is definitely playing a hell of a high-stakes game here, yep. because we're also talking about Vietnam, Japan. I see the EU making all sorts of overtures already. So there are a number of countries that have been brought to the bargaining table, which this was not the case a couple of days ago. And it's classic Trump, if you consider the art of the deal and the way that he usually does this. You take up an extreme position and then you work back from that. And the only way to get people to the bargaining table sometimes is to say to them, we're going to blow the whole thing up if you don't. Mm. And then
it's definitely his tactic, but he is coming across now more than ever as looking a bit foolish.
We'll see. We'll see. The proof will be in the pudding. All right. So Chris Hart is a South African economist and investment strategist known for his candid commentary on economic and political issues. He began his career as a science teacher before transitioning into finance. He works as a senior financial economist at Absa Capital and later as the chief strategist at Investment Solutions, which is a subsidiary of Alexander Forbes. And I'm very, very pleased to see him. Chris, it's so good to see you and have you here in the studio with us.
Thank you very much, Gareth.
Yes. Yeah, and Leanne and I are excited to talk to you about China and trade yes. wars and tariffs and all of that stuff. But I do have to just reflect on something that a couple of years ago, you were one of the first people that they tried to cancel on social media.
Yes,
because of your opinions.
Yes.
I remember that well. You survived. Well done. You're still here. Most of them are still living in their parents' basements. Yes.
Something right? like that, yeah. yes. I've since transitioned into impact investing.
Yes.
Right? And that's the main thing, is to see if one can actually try and transition. It's one of the problems we have in South Africa is that the absent part of our financial services sector is, in fact, and I say absent, is really access to capital for SMEs.
Right. Okay, so is that what impact in investment is all about?
No, if you go to Europe, it's pretty woke. You know, now that you're worried about the plastic straw and kind of thing. But
environmental sustainability. What is it, ESG, environmentally sustainability and
social
governance.
Social and governance, yeah.
What a lot of crap.
So to my mind, I look at it, impact investing, if you're going to do that here in Africa, it's got to be Africa relevant. Food, yeah. jobs, housing.
Energy.
Not even green energy, just energy.
Any right. energy.
And but we also have another factor called business ownership. In other words, we try and look to see if you can structure things where you fund people into their businesses and not out of their businesses.
Right.
Because that's the big problem with, if you could say, the normal venture capital private equity thing, is that we'd love your idea, we'll fund it, but we'll take 70% of your business or something
yeah,
like that.
Right.
And so you've got to try and see how can you actually fund people into their businesses as a whole thing.
Okay, yeah, so let's start with South Africa. We'll get to China eventually. I know, yes. Leanne is she's actually quite enthusiastic about this. I never thought the day would come, Leanne, where you and I would sit and talk about Chinese and American tariffs.
Yeah, you see, TikTok's an amazing place. It's made it very interesting.
I may just throw a word of caution in there and say, if TikTok is your source of this, you're going to find a very biased algorithm in favor of China. But let's just turn our attention. We've got Chris here, and it's a rare thing to talk about economics and to talk about how things affect South Africans. So let's just start with this, Chris. I mean, everybody is all bent out of shape, screaming at each other. Potentially, the government and national unity is going to fall apart. Tell me about this VAT hike and give me a little bit of perspective on this. How important is a 0.5% increase in VAT? How hard does it affect the average South African? Do we need to have a 0.5% tax increase? And what's the government trying to do?
So in my view, it's one of these, you do things at the edge. You keep incrementally increasing your burden. Right. And I think one of the things we need to get terminology right, we often speak about tax revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe you need to talk about the tax take, because revenue has an implication that it's earned. Okay.
They haven't earned it.
Whereas it's the
tax just taking it from you at the barrel of a gun.
And we need to use the term the burden of government, as opposed to, you know, government services. You know, we really do need to speak about that. Set the thing, because what has happened is that our government has a very socialist, Keynesian type of view on how you generate growth. And it's a spending model, but they want to spend it. Okay. So they don't believe that the private sector should have resources. They earn the money to their purpose in life is to actually pay taxes. And you often hear a narrative, speaking about that, you know, if you do this, there'll be more tax revenue. That's not my purpose in life, is to generate more tax take for the government. So we need to actually say there's a certain perspective that government needs to be put in place. But over the last, particularly since 2007, it's been, it was a pivotal change, but in fact, it's been going on since before then, that the government has continued to increase their burden, right? And the overall share of the economy, if you like, that they actually take, it's now well into the 30s. It's very, very high.
So this
30%.
This socialist Keynesian way of understanding the world, it clearly hasn't worked for some 15, 20 years, and yet they persist with it.
Well, I think let's go back to the 30s and Keynes and Cohn. How do you get out of the depression, and how do you calculate GDP? If private sector spends a rand, it gets added to GDP. If government spends a rand, it gets added to GDP. So it doesn't matter who's spending, as long as that's going up. But the problem was with consumption-led growth is it's also debt-led growth.
Right.
And we can see that. And it leads to these huge cyclical swings and roundabout. If you have investment-led growth, in other words, where you've got the structural capacity of the economy is growing faster than the demand, or keeping up with the demand of the economy, you don't get inflation, firstly. You saw that with Asian tiger growth, for instance, because it's not that you've got a factory that you've reached the capacity and you then have to raise interest rates to cool the economy down. You've built another factory and you've built more and more supply along with that that rising demand. And you can sustain very, very high growth rates if you have investment-led growth. The other big difference is if it's consumption-led growth, right, it's the multipliers in the economy is not nearly as high as investment-driven growth, because consumption, you buy a chocolate, you eat it, that's the end of it, right? Whereas if you buy a chocolate factory, it's something that endures, and creates multipliers, much more effectively over the longer period of time in South Africa. The solution to South Africa's problem is not what we see and what exists. It's what needs to come into existence. The economy is too small, but for the people in the economy. So we need to buy more economy. Now, when you say buy more economy, that's the other word we use is invest. All right, but you have to buy more factories, you have to buy more infrastructure, you have to buy. You can take everything in South Africa, you can look around and you can double it up. All right, and that's what we need to do.
Is it possible to do that? Are there countries that are getting that right?
Well, let's put it this way. If you do the calculations, South Africa from 94 to 2007, and I'll tell you why 2007 is quite critical, we underperformed the average. Right. Remember, it's not better than average. In other words, it's what is easily achievable. I've often said if we only could achieve mediocre, we'd be so doing so much better.
Yeah, we have aspirations to mediocrity in this country.
No, we don't. If we can achieve mediocre, because we've underperformed the average sub-Saharan Africa emerging market average growth by 1.5 percentage points from 94 to 2007. Then 2007 came another pivotal point, which was the dropping of the charges against Zuma. That's the breaking down of law and order, giving politicians impunity and shifting corruption from skimming to plunder, right, from that point.
That's what you believe happened there.
Well, that was when they dropped the charges against Zuma. That was a critical thing. But you can see it was a switch in the economy, hidden by the global financial crisis at the time. Mm-hmm. But what happened is that from that point till now, we've had an additional two percentage points underperforming. So we're underperforming emerging markets in sub-Saharan Africa by about 3.5 percentage points a year. And you compound that from 94 till the present, we would have an economy almost three times the size of what it is now, with unemployment below 8%. But that is the cost of what we call Muppet economics, okay, that has the spending mindset rather than an investment mindset. All right. And when I look at the comment, everybody has a growth budget. They all say growth, but they're actually not talking about growth, because the moment you say growth, my ears are listening. I'm saying, you want a growth budget? I now want to hear savings. That's the capital. What are you doing about to boost savings and translating that into investment in the economy? Those are the two factors. You could always add other factors. You know, you can have investment and technology. You can have investment and education. You can add invest, but you've got to have investment.
So what tools does the finance minister actually have at his disposal?
Huge. Because, massive.
All right, before we get into that even, we often expect like someone will come in and do everything.
Yeah.
Is that person the finance minister? You say he's got massive tools at his disposal. What kinds of things could he do as opposed to raising VAT by 0.5%?
Yeah, well, the first thing is he should be the first principle in tax. And remember, it's accountants and lawyers that determine the tax. Well, they don't always understand the economic implication of a tax. But I would step back and say, if you take a value chain, try and tax the end of the value chain and not milk the value chain, because you want the multipliers to run. Okay, you can't say we want beneficiation, but crush it at source with taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You've got to actually say, well, let's see that if you do this at the next step, there's a tax break. If you don't do it, you're going to incur tax, because that's the end of the value chain. So try and do that. The second thing is, no emerging market in the world can justify things, wealth taxes. And we've got at least three horrible wealth taxes, which damage the ability of the economy to accumulate capital.
What are those?
Capital gains tax.
Yeah, right? It's ridiculous.
It's like eating seeds and wondering why you're not getting harvest. The second thing is wealth taxes.
Well, you've already been taxed on the money that they're going to tax you on again.
Well,
I mean, like, even if you sell a property, for example, sell your shares in a business.
That's property transfer tax.
No, but that's another one.
That's another one. Okay, and then rates and taxes is that, and death duties. Those are all wealth taxes where the government takes it and converts it into consumption. It is stupid. Even if it wasn't taxed, you don't want it. And I know accountants have said, but if you don't tax capital gains, people will shift income into capital. So that's exactly the behavior we want.
Yeah.
Exactly the behavior. We want as much capital as possible because we need to get just to start eating slowly into the unemployment rate. We need an investment rate of about 25% of GDP. Ideally, it should be about 30%. At the moment, it's sitting at 15, all right? It's barely enough to cover depreciation, all right? And then we've had another huge efforts, a huge measure that's been taken now, and that's expropriation without compensation. And that is going to give the additional underperformance of the economy. But I don't know how much, but we will only see the damage, right, in a decade, right, when we actually see the difference and you've got enough data, because that's the problem with economics. You're looking in the rearview mirror and you have to have a look at data. But the first big shoe to fall that damaged the economy, that was hidden, was we can see it in the mining industry. The mining industry went X growth in 2001 on a specific day. On a specific day, it went from where people were investing to no growth beyond that.
What changed?
Through the mining charter, the BEE mining charter into the industry. All right. And from that moment, all South African assets, mining assets in your global houses like BHP Billiton, even Anglo, which is South African one, Rio Tinto, they actually shed South African assets. They're not interested in South African assets from then.
Well, who would be? You have to give someone who's done nothing in the business, who doesn't earn anything, is not paying money for their shares. But you have to give them a whole huge percentage of your business just because they're connected to someone in government.
So you give it away, they sell it, so you've got to do it again.
Yeah.
You know, et cetera. And it's not anybody.
It's got to be a cater.
Yeah. The list is given to you. You can't just do something, you know, for general. And the problem with that is that these are laws that nobody else applies anywhere else in the world.
No.
You know, we'll discuss it in South Africa.
They would be laughed at in any other country.
We discuss it, and it's quite surreal because our mindset is we're going to deal with the legacy of apartheid. But I believe what they implemented was a policy of economic transfer rather than a policy of growth. So if you go back a century and go back to, you know, post Anglo-Boer War, etc., Afrikaans community is devastated that we've now got the Union of South Africa, and we have a sort of affirmative action there. But the Afrikaners see there's Old Mutual, we set up Sanlam.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say there's Old Mutual, we'll take it. Thank you very much. They saw Standard Bank, we'll set up Volkskas, and etc. So it was a policy of economic growth. One can argue, you know, is it ideal, and it's maybe suboptimal, but there's an intervention that actually added to the economy rather than, you know,
this is parasitizing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the problem being too small, if we go, you know, very often we love to chat about percentages, right, and how unfair things are when we're talking about percentages, is this is how futile things like the redress project policies are.
Mm-hmm.
Is if we take the number of people employed in South Africa, it's about 16 million. The number of people who need jobs is about 12 to 14 million. All right. The unemployment rate amongst whites is about 9-10%. Amongst blacks, much higher.
Why is that?
Well, let's go away from the percentages, because that's the point I'm trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
Is that if we had no affirmative action policies at all, and we then got investment in and we generated 5 million jobs, but it's the bad old days of apartheid. The first jobs that we create go to whites and the rest go to black. How many white people are unemployed? It's 100,000.
Really?
So if you create 5 million jobs, it can only be blacks. There are no other people to do. So what's the point of the affirmative action?
Well, it's actually just, I mean, it's very small-minded. The cake is only so big, so we're going to keep cutting into ever smaller pieces.
It's a socialist mindset that this is the cake, and we've got to deal with the cake as it is.
Right, and we'll apportion this because the state will decide who gets what.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a terrible system, and I can't believe that in the last 15 years someone hasn't woken up and gone, hang on,
but even,
we're on the wrong track here.
Even on the employment numbers, if you say, okay, let's remove all whites out of the economy and replace them with blacks. You're taking 2 million whites out of the economy, replacing them with blacks, and your black unemployment rate will still be the need for 12 million jobs instead of 14 million jobs. In other words,
but it's easy to focus on this scapegoating and it's the Jews or it's the whites or it's the Indians whatever.
The point is, when it comes to growth and entrepreneurship, etc., it's all hands on deck.
Yeah,
we have to.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to just move from us and this VAT thing, because I do think that that's kind of small-minded and boring.
Yeah, so the VAT was not necessary because we need to be shifting to investment, not consumption. It doesn't make a difference on the margin, but it's additional growth. So if you now say, is this a growth budget? No, it isn't, because you're shifting resources to the government, which is lower multiplier expenditure because they don't have a commercial reason to spend the money compared to private sector, and you're shifting it to consumption rather than investment.
Do we have any idea of how much has been stolen through corruption and how much money this economy has lost to just very grey things that we don't even know about? And then suddenly Eskom, can't buy coal, or suddenly our deficit is growing at this rate a year. Or
it's difficult, but very often the Auditor General will come in and say, okay, there's at Eskom there was 20 billion rand of wasteful, fruitless expenditure, for instance. Okay, and that's very much an auditor role because there's a paper trail and that sort of thing. But that also helps anchor our mind that it's like 20 billion, 3 billion. It's not 800-900 billion or even a trillion.
Yeah, I'm trying to get a grip on overall number.
What then happens is that Eskom, here's Eskom Power Station, and here's a mine, let's say, owned by Anglo, and they provide the coal to thing. But now that's not allowed. Right, you've got to now pass it through an intermediary.
Okay. A BEE intermediary.
So Anglo still sells their coal, call it 100 rand a ton, all right? And the intermediary then sells it, not at 110, but like 400-500 rand a ton.
Wow, you know, big margins.
It's a huge amount. So in the auditor, there's the paper, there the things balance, etc., and there's the invoice, there's the contract, and it passes the accounting.
Is that the kind of markup that these middlemen put in there?
Well, I've been told that the markups can be quite astonishing, and then you also have a factor whether the truck will arrive, all right, full, measured, etc., and it'll leave full, and then arrive back, all right, before they actually do it. So it can sometimes, that's just gate.
What's the same truck?
It's the same truck with the same coal, etc., but it's
being counted twice.
It's coming in. And how do you know there's a whole pile of coal, et cetera? But
All right. So let's talk about what everybody's interested in at the moment, because I think we'll talk about your book too. I know for people who are interested in BRICS, I think it's really important that we refer to this, because we're part of this, for better or worse, BRICS alliance with Brazil and Russia and India and China. And we're the minnow in that arrangement, but we have a role to play. So let's get to that just now. First, let's talk about Trump and America and the global trade war and the tariffs going up everywhere. What do you think is happening here? Use your much more trained eye to give us a little insight.
I'm going to start with the simplicity. Okay. When we export to Europe or the US, we open factories. When we export to China, we close factories.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I understand the sentiment that China's built up these things, but there's an increasing resentment, not just in America, but in the, you know, the world, that China would insist that if you're going to produce to their market, you've got to actually produce in China, and the Communist Party wants half your shares of the...
Again, the parasitic government.
And, yeah. And the reason you would climb those walls, those barriers, is because of the deep potential that you have in China. Right? We look at it and we will copy China, but there isn't the same deep potential behind behind these walls. So America is saying we're done with this. We want to actually have a fairer trade thing. So it's not. They are then saying we'll put reciprocal trade tariffs on. Okay, so if you charge us 60%. We're going to charge you 30%. That's not completely reciprocal, but it sharpens the mind to say, what kind of deal do you want with the US? Right? If you want to actually still continue to export at zero tariffs, reciprocate with zero tariffs. You know,
I mean, that's the ideal, right? Is that we all end up with zero tariffs because then we can have proper free trade.
Exactly. So it's not the same as the 30s where everybody put barriers up.
Mm.
Right? It's actually breaking them down. But it's the threat of higher barriers that are bringing people to the
So then Trump is playing a game of 4D chess, and yes, we may be underestimating him. I mean, he has famously said things like his mojo is deal making. That's what he loves. That's what he wants to do. And do you think that it is possible for him to get the kind of deals done with the countries surrounding China in the Pacific, and also the countries that are China's major trading partners, where they can assert themselves, this is the Americans now,
yes,
as the global hegemon that they believe they are, and where they can actually open up trade rather than let it become more closed?
Yeah, so you're already getting countries like Vietnam, etc., that say, we'll have a zero trade deal with you, because what's going to happen, remember, it's global multinationals that have chosen to set up their factories in China. They may say, okay, I'm going to set it up in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then enjoy that reciprocity, because Vietnam has certain advantages, lower wages or whatever the case is, and they can actually, you know, they are actually able to compete. Right? And we've got to actually look at it in the same way. And the advantages to South Africa is that we're forced to look at our competitiveness. We can't put our own moat around here and, you know, say neocolonialism and whatever epithet you want to actually.
Sure.
We need adults in the room to actually say, in this kind of world, okay, we actually have to rise to the point beyond mediocre, but to actually become excellent, which will be a good thing for South Africa. If we choose to say, okay, we're just going to throw a lot in with China, etc., America's going to maybe deal with us in a different way. And I know in my own mind is that they may say, let's support Cape Exit.
Yeah.
All right.
Or something
so you
else.
Can imagine, how are we going to defend against Cape? If they park their aircraft carrier off Cape Town and the Navy sends their rowing boat with one broken oar out to meet.
You know, by
the
way, Jan van Riebeek had more working ships than our current Navy do. Do you know that? Jan van Riebeek had three ships when he arrived in the Cape in 1652. Mm. We currently have two working ships in our Navy.
Yes.
If that isn't embarrassing, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, so you're thinking that America, they have the might to be able to get involved in ways that we don't even know yet.
Exactly.
And even if it's just by sheer economic power, we need them more than they need us.
Well, I'll go back to this again. The simplicity is that our relationship with the US is that they're happy and they're open. They're a consumer society. They will take manufactured goods, in other words, goods with lots of value add, right, including finished cars, right? They will take that, right? Whereas China doesn't, they block it. Okay, they'll take our raw materials with pleasure,
yeah,
right, and send, you know, with that, and I think You'll find, for instance, the European Union say, we're going to resist this, etc. But they will have to do a deal with the US because that's their more valuable trading partner.
Sure.
But they're not going to say, well, then we'll actually allow China to hemorrhage, right, our industry, you know, through the back door. They're going to do something similar. So it might well be China is playing the tough man because of their internal politics. But the problem with that China faces is that their internal system is extremely leveraged, maybe over-leveraged.
Yeah.
And that requires growth at the margin. So even if you say, okay, well, US trade, China's exports to the US is only like 3% of Chinese GDP, that 3% is at the margin.
Yeah.
Right. In a very leveraged system.
And their system is so like a house of cards because
yes. Well, that's they've the house
got
of cards,
to have
yes.
They've got to have growth because yes. Their population is at such an enormous the population dynamics are at such fractious and dangerous numbers.
Exactly.
And the economy has to keep up with that or else you end up with a major, major problem.
Yes.
And the Chinese government don't need instability. And the only way to secure themselves against instability is to keep growth going. Keep growth. So they also have internal pressures that we mustn't consider to be unimportant. Let me just ask you, because you wrote this book, you co-authored a book on BRICS called BRICS Halfway There.
Yes.
Is BRICS really a going concern at the moment? How seriously should we take it? How seriously do you think the Americans, particularly the new administration in Washington, thinks BRICS is? And tell us where the role of this alliance that we're cobbled into with Brazil and Russia and India and China will take us.
I see when it was just the five BRICS,
yeah,
five countries, it was a fairly disparate group of countries.
Hmm.
With their own internal rivalries. Russia, India, China China's got disputes with both
sure.
Russia and China. It's not, and they're not easy disputes. So it's not a natural thing. But what is happening with China actually now, I'll use the term Japanification of China. In other words, that they may well go into a period of a decade of stagnation as they try and actually unwind some of the excesses that they've built. It doesn't mean a lot of what's there is not real, right? But there's also a lot that is is bubble-like. Like Japan got it, and it took them three decades, and they're still battling with the excesses of that huge bubble that they had at the end of the 1980s and the stock exchange. So you may well find that China goes into stagnation and India increasingly takes a bigger lead. And there's two reasons for that. One is that the Indian growth is a lot more solid, all right, and it's less state-driven because their deep socialism is receding, but their population may well be significantly more than China. In other words, it's recently, on the official numbers, you know, eclipsed. Both of them have got, you know, 1.4 billion people and some change with, you know, the Indian change a little bit more than the Chinese, apparently. But there may well be a population gap of about, you know, on the numbers of a few hundred million.
It's a lot of people.
It is quite a lot of people.
It's substantial. It's like double our total population if they just undercalculate by 100 million, right?
You know, our population's a rounding error, you know,
compared
to that. And their rounding error, you know, may well be, you know, three or four times the size of our population. But the point is that it's a very difficult. They are in a very difficult position, as the dynamic goes. But in terms of BRICS, it does look like it's now they're trying to find purpose. I've often said, is this it's a politically driven thing? In other words, it's not necessarily driven by economics. It's not like the European Union where you've got at least some cultural consistency, if you like,
right,
across the region. But I think it looks like it was transforming, and it is transforming into what was in the Cold War, the non-aligned movement, which mm-hmm. is not really that non-aligned, all right, but really seeking there as some sort of organization against the West, right? And India is there, and they're not necessarily against the West. They're actually conducting...
No, big buddy-buddy with Trump at the moment.
Well, India has a very self-assertive foreign policy. They say, we will do what's good for India. India.
Yeah, and if pragmatic.
I don't care about your issue with Russia. It's not our issue with right. Russia. We will trade with Russia. I don't care about, you know, so, and India is now big enough for people to, you know, tiptoe around. It's their military is, in fact, very, very powerful. Right. It's not just a ragtag third world no. sort of thing. It's actually quite a modern, efficient, with quite a lot of capacity, right? You know, in terms of aircraft, nuclear power, they've got satellites. It's not, you know, that they've...
Well, they've had to with Pakistan on their border, and there's been an ongoing dispute there for years.
And that will continue. But Pakistan is now falling back in this race more and more. And they can't keep up. But I think the problem is the religious order is shifting more and more radical, and it's becoming a lot more difficult to manage and engage with the world.
Okay, so BRICS, we don't really derive that much of a benefit from it as it is at the moment. Is there any reason other than South Africa giving a middle finger to the West because maybe we don't like Donald Trump, or we think that he's focused on the wrong issues here, or he's talking about Afrikaners or farm murders, and we don't like that? Do we stay in BRICS just to piss the Americans off? Is this going to get us any benefit from China, Russia, India? Are we part of something that could give rise to an alternate global currency which is used more than the dollar?
I think...
Or would they come to our rescue?
Would they?
No, would they?
If the U.S.
Because I can see a situation where China or India make a deal with the U.S. and we end up sucking the hind tit again.
Yeah. I think what's the issues that, you know, when it comes to global trade choke points, etc., I think what the Trump is doing, they're saying Panama, Greenland, etc., we want to actually secure trade routes. And they think a lot more global in that basis. China will be thinking Singapore Strait, etc., pretty much,
mm-hmm.
And the Taiwan Strait. You know, let's see if we can, you know, secure that kind of thing. If something happens here, I don't think they'll step in. They don't have the ability to project their power like the US can. Right. Again, the Chinese can send their three aircraft carriers and America will send their, you know, 30 or
yeah, sure.
You know, it's just no match, you know,
right,
at this stage. So certainly they cannot project that power. And I think
in any case, they've always been much more soft power than hard power.
Yes.
And they think long term in China.
Exactly. But when you're now looking at what happened in the Suez Canal, the Cape Sea route becomes a lot more strategic.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think Trump is interested in that. I don't think Trump is the factor, right? I think in the DNA of the ANC, they are anti-West.
Yeah.
Right. In other words, when Biden was there, they were anti-West. In other words, they were pissing off the Americans, Democrat and Republican, already well before. Yeah. The Trump is just pushing the needle and touching the boil, and our, you know, response was typically puerile, you know, instead of actually trying to understand and say, how do we respond to this in a sensible way that goes, you know, neocolonialism, you know, racist, you know, all of that kind of
same old hymn book
stuff. And that's not interesting to them. That's, oh, really? Right. Well, yeah. Let's look at other measures.
So when they talk about things that America could do to make our lives a lot more difficult, There are obviously a lot of those. There could be a discussion, and I don't really need to get into any detail on this with you because they're more important things to discuss. But if the US decided to sanction ANC leaders, for example, how does that actually affect their wallet?
Well, I think the first thing we need to start with is America have imposed no sanctions at all. There are no sanctions. It's just that they've withdrawn aid.
Which already is hurting us.
And that's the thing. A lot of the programs say, look what we're doing for AIDS. Actually, the Americans are doing it. You know, that's
being
exposed quite a bit. So it starts to become extremely awkward, right? Because if they're now going into transactions, you know, you can look at your credit card, debit cards, etc. It's got either Visa, MasterCard, and American Express. Those are all American platforms, Swift, etc. There's all sorts of things. Now, the BRICS, you could say China, Russia, etc., creating alternative platforms, that's fine. But the best quality of our trade is with the West. Right? And our economy will struggle. Right? And from an electoral point of view, the ANC is already reaping the rewards, the electoral rewards of a high unemployment rate, etc. They're now
They're 40, being punished.
They are now. Well, I've got to try and work out, you know, how the electoral system. People say it's 41, you know, 40 point whatever percent, but they've got 39.7% of the seats in Parliament, you know. So, it's certainly, call it a 40% party, and the polls are indicating a further slippage, which I would expect. And we're seeing this enormous swing against this is a bit of a tangent, but an enormous swing against the ruling party in urban areas, which is common across Africa. You saw it in Kenya, in Tanzania, in Zambia, etc. The urban population is the one that swings first. The only difference is they're 80% rural countries, and we're 68% urban countries.
Right.
And that's the strategic blunder of the ANC. They ruralized, and rather as a party rather than looked at the urban thing, and they're actually losing ground quite a bit on that basis.
Okay, so it's 19 rand and 1 cent to the dollar at the moment.
Oh, much stronger, hey?
Yeah. Sorry, so that's looking good, but it is Monday, so it could change again.
Who said, you know, 19 rand to the dollar would be a good thing?
I know, but we were at a much worse position just a couple of days ago. Exactly. So how do you see all of this going? Because people often will judge, I think, in a very binary sense, how well or poorly a country's doing just from currency exchanges. And that's a very, very simplified and not necessarily granular way of understanding economics. But where do you see the rand going? Because I hear a lot of South Africans bemoaning the fact that, oh, it doesn't matter how hard I work. It doesn't matter how much I get to take home. In the end, it's going to be worthless because this country is being run like a spaza shop and the government don't know what they're doing.
I think, firstly, one needs to understand, I've increasingly been looking at this, and I'm going to be very careful here because there's Muppets out there who's going to look at it and say, who do not understand the concept of a scenario as opposed to a forecast, as opposed to, understanding, you know, the difference between sentiment and fundamentals. You've got them, and they think, you know, one tweet is there. So I've already put out there, you know, a few years back, and that was ahead of the electoral conference, you know, of the ANC. If Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma comes, we could have a collapse of sentiment and the rand going to a big amount. And I said 60, but the point is it's not 60. That's the number. It's that you actually have that crash that is very common when you actually have a sudden withdrawal of confidence, etc. What we've got is the slow puncture. Okay, it's just easing out, and so you have a continual, and you'll have the rent fluctuating, and you'll have the volatility, etc. But the rent's not going back to 18. All right, it's shifting to a higher trading band at the moment, and the trend is weaker. And the reason is the effect of expropriation without compensation. I don't care how it gets spinned.
Yeah.
You know, zero is zero. You know, if you didn't intend that, why have that legislation? What's misinformation about that? Don't care how many procedures you. If you're going to take somebody's stuff for no compensation, it can never, ever be. It's completely untenable, right? Doesn't matter, all right. But nevertheless, there's an odious political intention behind it, and we know it. You know, that may well see an acceleration of rent weakness going forward. Okay. And again, it's going to exacerbate the underperformance of the economy and also social stability if that is left to stand. That's why it's so critical that that gets clawed back. Okay, it's actually got to be clawed back. We've got to actually reestablish the rule of law.
Right.
Right. In other words, politicians, the Zondo Commission is there. Nobody's going, nobody of significance who's been mentioned, etc. We've got a prosecuting authority that was broken. And that's the whole point about impunity, is that you break the police, so no investigation gets done. If something slips through there, all right, then get to the prosecuting authority, which then is also broken. If something slips through there, you then have a magistrate that's not there. And if that slips through, there's the medical parole board, you know, that's on the other side. You know,
to old
spring your comrades out of jail. Exactly. Right. So we've seen this before, but so far we haven't seen, you know, any convictions. And what'll happen is they'll botch the prosecutions. Do you remember the Kebble murder?
Yeah.
Right. It says, I did it. I paid for it. You had all, but the prosecution was so bungled.
They're so stupid. They screwed up. Yeah.
Now that was deliberate.
Yeah,
we know it was. Okay. And that's the point about a broken justice system where law is applied arbitrarily. If they feel like taking you on, they can conjure things up, right? If they want to, right? But if you have committed a crime, does it get even investigated? Well, we've seen it. The police will take a case, and 3 days later, they'll close it with lack of evidence, but the policeman just didn't do anything at all about it. No investigation at all, closed, and that is off their books.
And these things have a cost too. I mean, there's so much other stuff I wanted to ask you. I haven't even given Leanne a chance here.
Sorry.
I'm just absorbing everything. It's fascinating.
But You talk about South Africa's economy and what it could be. Give us the best case scenario, because I always like to kind of look at what optimistically could really be achieved if we just got our act together, and then what the worst case scenario is too.
The ability to transact freely.
In other words,
if I want to actually do a transaction with you on full commercial, you know, in other words, I think it's commercially optimal that I transact with you rather than you. Right, it's the nature of the game. That is a critical part of a prosperous economy.
Are you saying we don't have that now?
No, BE is an example of financial repression.
Yeah.
Right, it's financial repression where I can't just do a deal with you. I've actually got to include somebody else who I don't even know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the first thing. So you need to transact freely. You need to be able to enforce those contracts. So you've got to
So we need rule of law.
Exactly.
And we need fair laws that don't discriminate.
Property rights. Those are the three legs. You can have other things in there. I don't care about minimum wage, for instance. If you've got those three things in place,
everything else will work.
For any economy that has those three things in place, you change from poor to rich in a single generation. You've seen this time and time again. And we've got all the elements. If we put those three things, we correct those three things, we will actually make up the lost ground. We will attract the investment. And yes, there's all sorts of other things. We need to be more competitive from a tax rate point of view. We've gone beyond the Laffer curve. We need to bring those tax rate down, etc. Dividend tax is one that needs to come because it just raises the hurdle rate. Right? If you've got, you see, if you have a look at an opportunity set, for instance, and it's the best of few, but there's, you know, that's at the top. Your opportunity set, you don't want the worst thing, so no. You don't want, but the moment you say, I'm an investor, I want 20%, but there's this capital gains tax, so I actually need a project that yields 30%,
right,
so that I can get my 20%. All right. The 30% project's a lot harder to come by.
Sure.
All right. And that's what we need to do, see if we can lower the hurdle rate to unlock the potential of the country.
And you mentioned the Laffer curve. I think it's worth just explaining that to people who might not have heard it.
The Laffer curve was found at the beginning of the 80s when Thatcher took over and tax rates were very, very high. You had the marginal tax rate that was over 90%. In other words, if you earned above a certain amount, they took it. Our marginal rate was 72%. That's when they introduced VAT, by the way, GST at the time.
Yeah.
But they introduced that so that they could reduce it. And so what happened is that tax rates were taken from that 90% right down to 40, you know, in that region. And they thought with the bad finances that the UK economy was in, you know, it's going to get even worse for the government, etc. Mm-hmm. Firstly, we're not here to solve the government's problem. They actually had to help serve us, but we're at the moment serving the government. But
yeah,
what they found, they cut it, and they actually got quite a bit more in at the 40% than they were getting at the 90%. And that's where this...
So it's like your Goldilocks zone of tax.
Yeah, so there's an optimal... You know, there's an optimal point where you're extracting the maximum tax that taxes... That'll get. Cigarette tax is another example, in that we cut it and reduce the incentive for smuggling and enforce the law properly, but we get more in. Okay, but you will not get more in by raising the taxes more.
Yeah.
Okay, you will not.
Yeah, but this is also a lack of imagination on the part of the people in charge of Treasury, because they only see one lever.
Yeah, but also... One of the big things is that also happened in the 80s, which helped to end stagflation, is you had privatization. So you shifted from the government business model, which, and we see this with Eskom, say, what are my costs and what do I need to charge to cover my costs?
Right.
Whereas the private sector model says,
to make profit.
No, they'll take a thing. What will the market bear? And what must my costs be for me to be in that market?
Right, so you cut your coat according to your cloth.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you can't just – there's a huge incentive to contain costs. And government is run like this. We need to spend so much, so we need to raise taxes to that to cover it. Mm-hmm. Right. And we need to actually. You need to cut your expenditure to cut. You know, to suit your tax base.
There's no way they're going to do that, though.
We need to get a political. At the moment, it's a political establishment that is thinking at margins. We need our own Doge inside the two. Is this necessary? And actually cut out the corruption of expenditure. If you just cut the corruption of not what it's for. In other words, take the ghosts out of the of SASSA. I actually don't believe there's 28 million people receiving. I think there's a lot. It's so difficult to get onto SASSA, all right, that people give up, right? But I think you put an application in, they've now got your details. They block it every way of your sense, but somebody's getting that money.
Sure.
that was.
I don't know. There's definitely fraud and corruption going on at an extraordinary level. And we also know that, you know, like Doge's discovered in America, you've got 155-year-olds supposedly still on social welfare, and they've got disability grants, and they've got veteran.
And illegals getting
grants and all kinds of things, voting rights.
So we need that. And I think governments around the world are looking at this, looking at Argentina, looking at things to see the utter waste when you bring, take the veil away and your population, which is under this enormous burden of government because of the tax take, they believe that the fruits of your labor, they're entitled
belong to them.
Yeah, and that's...
So, Chris, I do want to rush this. We're meant to have stopped, and I wanted to find out from you what you think of what Javier Milei is doing in Argentina.
You know what happened? They cut expenditure, so that means the GDP went down, right? And then private sector,
grew.
But what happened is that the private sector shot up. Remember the multipliers in the private sector. Argentina is going to see an absolute boom next year. Right. It's still in the thing, but the growth is busy building up.
Yep.
And that boom is going to astonish people. The US is also going to go into a boom because they're cutting taxes, cutting regulations, in other words, government getting out of the way.
Uh-huh.
Now, that is, we don't appreciate we pay tax directly, but then we pay a hell of a lot of money to actually comply with regulation.
Yep.
Right. And these are costs that are unfunded. It raises the cost. It keeps inflation down by cutting the regulation. And I'm not saying no regulation. I'm not that advocate. But any regulation that has any value, you can sell. That's just me being a thing. You can sell good regulation. If it's not adding value, you can't. It shouldn't be there as well. But these countries going into a boom where the U.S. growth could actually, exceed 5% next year. It won't do it this year, but certainly 5%. And you may well see Argentine growth, at around the 9-10% mark.
That's very good. Okay, well, from your mouth to God's ears, let's hope that South Africa follows the best case scenario that you were talking about.
Yes.
I don't know that the Muppet system that we've got here is going to necessarily conform with sensible, pragmatic approaches, but we live in hope.
Yes.
And I do think that the world is a very, very interesting place to be watching right now because it's all happening. We're living in real history in real time.
We've got real life case studies of
absolutely.
If you do something completely different.
And you can see which ones are a total disaster and which ones are being... already claimed as huge successes.
Yeah.
Let's see which side of that coin we end up on.
Yes.
And I'm delighted to see you again. Keep doing the good work that you've been doing. I'm so pleased that all attempts to cancel you were failures all those years ago. And I wish you luck.
Thank you
very much. It's very nice to see you again, Chris.
Thank you very much, Gareth.
Thank you, Ass.
Thank you. I'm hoping we can maybe play out with if Flex allows us to.
Yeah.
With the China Trump clip.
Oh, yeah. They're having lots of fun with memes, right?
Yes. Okay. Those memes, yes. But this is a Chinese guy who does impersonations of Trump.
All right, we'll do that in a second. Just remember, next Monday, we don't have a live show because we are all on holiday in South Africa on Monday next week. So Leanne will be back the following Monday. But here is a China, because he says China. China and Trump clip for you to end everything off. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you on Wednesday.